Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Before we do anything, once again, this is our day three. Colonel Vindman, every single day between now and the election, we need to remember Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth.
So let me start with a sort of, how do I say this? Scott's not here. That's how I say it. Scott Braddock is known as the voice of Texas. He is the dean of the Austin Press Corps. He's also the editor of the Quorum Report. And this has been a wild, wild week for anyone covering Super Tuesday, especially in Texas, where we saw lines and lines and lines of people. And of course, Scott was at the forefront of all this, the coverage, as well as trying to do the analysis for people both locally as well as nationally. And as a result, he has the day off. We give it to him, and we are very grateful. Let me remind you that we taped the show on Thursday morning, so truly he does need a day off. This is going to be heard on Friday, but we tape on Thursday morning. So I'm going to start with that. But that doesn't mean that we don't have a great voice on the air with us. So I saw a letter that a friend of mine, who I see fairly about every other year, every 5 years, but I've known him for a long time, Paul Peter Jessup. When I asked him, I said, how would you describe yourself, Paul Peter? And this is how he did. He's so friggin' modest. He described himself as a New York attorney, past member of the New Hampshire Republican State Committee, and former Portsmouth GOP city chair. He also said he registered as a Republican last month to be a Weld presidential delegate in New York. He won't qualify to be on the ballot, so we'll have to change his registration back to unaffiliated. Folks, I decided that I was going to look up Paul Peter Jessup and find out a little bit more about him because I think he is being way, way, way too modest. He earned a JD from Western New England University Law School, a Master's of Professional Studies in Political Management from the Graduate School of Political Management, now based at George Washington University. He earned a Master of Arts from Bangor Theological Seminary in Maine. He is serving as a corporate chaplain. He practices law in New York. He's author of Crucifying Jesus and Secularizing America, The Republic of Faith Without Wisdom. I could go on and on and on. In other words, he is just a master of the word, both print as well as oral. And I want to welcome Paul Peter to the program.
I'm blushing. You know, if my father heard that lovely introduction, he would be in disbelief. So thank you.
Well, when I asked you, I said, send me like a two-liner. I read it and I'm like, this is so not satisfying. I want people to know how much I value you. So you voted for Weld. You are, or maybe were, a member of the Ripon Society. You've been the city chair in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, now living in New York as a Republican. And of course, I think knowing you so well, the Republican Party has totally abandoned you, Paul Peter. And to some extent, I feel slightly abandoned by my own Democratic Party because I belong to the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, represented by people like Paul Wellstone and Russ Feingold. And I kind of look at how we sort of corporatized the party. But while we may have corporatized the party and became more like the moderate Republicans that maybe you are, what has happened to the Republican Party is something that is so off the charts that I'm not sure we can quite comprehend. So as we approach the November 2020 election, what do people like Paul Peter do? And given what we saw in Super Tuesday, which was pretty interesting because there was enormous turnout, enormous turnout. And I think the enormous turnout wasn't really as much about an embrace of Joe Biden as much as a scream against Donald Trump. So I'm kind of laying a lot on the table and let you pick up whatever you want. But we are living in such interesting times, and the urgency of the moment seems overwhelming. And if it's overwhelming for me, I can't imagine someone who used to be a card-carrying member of the Republican Party and what they're looking at a Republican Party that has abandoned so much of their, I think, historic values.
I think we're living in a national nightmare. I find this period of time in our national consciousness surreal. You know, the Republican Party at one time talked about balanced budgets. We now have one of the largest deficits in the last 75 years. And, of course, we have a president who declared bankruptcy three times, so we shouldn't be surprised by that. We were the party, or the Republican Party, believed in protecting the environment. You could look at the first national parks were created by Republicans, right. Teddy Roosevelt. Right. You could look at the fight for civil rights in the 1960s and 1970s. They were Republicans. The first civil rights laws in this country were passed in the state of New York by a governor named Thomas E. Dewey. The first real effort to integrate a major police department, a fire department, occurred in New York City under a Republican mayor named John Lindsay. We could look at the record of Jacob Javits, who was a U.S. senator, and Margaret Chase Smith. They were fierce advocates for civil rights and civil liberties. I don't know what happened to the Republican Party. It is stunning. It doesn't represent my values, my principles. And so, being a patriotic American, I will look for the best candidate. Right now, that's Joe Biden. As you mentioned, Governor Weld, I was a huge fan, am a huge fan of Governor Weld. He did a brilliant job as governor of Massachusetts. And he decided to run for president. Unfortunately, he's not going to qualify to be on the ballot. I was registered unaffiliated in the state of New York. I can't subscribe to the Republican Party anymore. But I changed my affiliation because I believe so strongly in Bill Weld that I agreed to be a delegate for him if he got on the ballot. That's not going to happen. I'm changing my registration back to unaffiliated, and I will support publicly and financially Joe Biden.
So I want to get to Joe Biden, but I want to sort of get to him sort of next. And that is that you mentioned Bill Weld and what kind of a governor he was in Massachusetts. So let me just say something for Republicans. You all need to be Republicans in Massachusetts. And the reason I'm saying that, and you know exactly why, I'm looking at Charlie Baker, another governor of Massachusetts who's a Republican in this supposedly very lefty blue state. I'm looking at Mitt Romney, the only one to actually support impeachment against Donald Trump, a former Republican governor of Massachusetts. There's something sort of soothing about putting a Republican in a sort of petri dish of Democrats. I think they actually make each other better. And I'm saying that in a really honest way. You mentioned, you know, the idea of Republicans being opposed to deficits. And now look at what happened under Donald Trump. We have an enormous deficit. So I'm going to sort of defend a little bit about Democrats and deficits, but also compliment Republicans and deficits. The Republican Party that actually raised me, my father, my mother, the Republicans that basically embraced me when I was a young legislator, even though I was the young Turk, the backbencher, you know, the lefty progressive. But it was Republicans that taught me. Okay, the Republican Majority Leader, Bruce Rounds, John Tucker, all those people, amazing Republicans. Okay, and they were the best of teachers. But one of the things I realized is, and let's go to the term deficit. So Republicans historically said, if you can't afford it, you don't do it. Okay. So they said, so in a way, they saw taxes as a way of sort of tempering the sort of galloping into program after program, because people needed to know you have to pay for it now. And if you're willing to pay for it now, we'll pass the program. If you're not willing to tax yourself and pay for it now, we're not going to pass the program. So the idea was sort of that the taxes was sort of a way of reining people in from doing something that might be far beyond what we were able to both afford and maybe what we ultimately may want it. Democrats, however, thought that on occasion it might be appropriate to go into deficit if the deficit was going to provide some kind of infrastructure investment or program that was necessary now. Maybe there was an economic downturn and you couldn't pay for it immediately, but eventually the goal was to pay for it eventually. Okay, so there were investments that represented the deficit as opposed to what we have with Donald Trump, which is a deficit with no investment, which is a deficit about giving, you know, unlimited cash back to the 1% that were already ridiculously wealthy. It was about giving, you know, corporate America the kind of tax cut, even in their wildest dreams, they never imagined and frankly didn't even ask for, which is so shocking. And when you look at companies like Amazon, some of the richest companies in the world that pay zero in taxes, and yet the guy that's cleaning your street is paying more, you have to start asking yourself, what the hell did that deficit serve? But to make the rich richer and basically sort of undermine our ability to respond to things, for example, like now, COVID-19. For example, like now, climate change. For all the other things that we're facing going into the future. So it's really interesting to me that I think Republicans need Democrats and Democrats need Republicans. And now we don't know how to find each other because of what Donald Trump has done to so distort the Republican Party.
I think the Republican Party of our generation, if I can say that, is basically dead. I mean, there was a Republican Party where there was a collegiality, there was civility, there was consensus building, there was an understanding in the legislative process that it was about compromise. It was not my way or the highway. Where has that gone? That was the brand of the moderate Republican. I would also say that we ultimately have to have voters held accountable. You know, we want to talk about how toxic Donald Trump is, and he is toxic and he needs to be voted out of office. And there are many Republicans that need to be voted out of office. But ultimately, voters have given this guy a free pass. You mentioned tax breaks for the super wealthy. So the Koch brothers are getting a tax break. The Walmart family is getting a tax break. They certainly don't need tax breaks. And how does Donald Trump plan to pay for it? He wants to slash the Medicaid program. So let's talk about West Virginia, one of the poorest states in the United States. And guess what? They're going to reelect Donald Trump, and they're the ones who are going to be hugely impacted if he succeeds in slashing Medicaid.
I find it mind-boggling
that people will vote for this man or vote for his reelection, and they're the ones who are being screwed, and they don't see it.
So Paul Peter, I want someone like you to stand up in front of all these West Virginians and say, why? Why? Do you value your life or do you value the verbiage of Donald Trump? Do you value your children or do you believe the lies of Donald Trump? Do you value whether you're going to have a job in the future? And exactly what you said. And you're going to say, if you vote for him, you are going to live and die by this decision. And more operatively, you're probably going to die by this decision because you are expendable with Donald Trump. You are expendable even as you enhance him and you vote for him and you support him. Because you think you want to say screw you to everyone, guess what your vote just did? It said screw you to yourself. Put a damn mirror up. I don't see anybody with the balls to say it. And I just want people to say, and I want to say, play out your vote. Play out your vote for your children. Play out your vote for your health care. Play out your vote for your community. Play out your vote for your future job. And as you play out your vote, why the hell are you doing this? And if you do, then maybe you're saying to me that you don't want anything in the way of assistance. So guess what? When you suddenly come knocking on the door, remind yourself what you empowered, because what you empowered has turned his back on you.
We have national pundits, some of whom are quite good. You've got Joe and Mika, you've got Ari Melber, and I respect them, I like them. I have a message for them. When are you going to start holding voters accountable for what they did?
I agree.
Let's talk about the immigration issue. Okay, fine, reform immigration. You do not take children away from their parents at the border. You don't do that. That's not a liberal issue. It's not a conservative issue. It's not a Republican issue. It's not a Democratic issue. It's an ethical and moral issue. And shame on any American who can rationalize it and be complacent about it. They're the ones who need to be held accountable. Do they have no conscience?
Well, wait.
They think that it's okay to put children in cages?
Well, wait, but Paul Peter, you know what I would do? So having been in the legislature and you having been around politics a long time, it was always my conservative Republican friends who were very angry when the courts would come in and separate families. They would prefer to leave because children were chattel. Do you know what I mean? They would prefer to leave kids in an abusive setting. They would always somehow genuflect to the idea that the child was served better by staying with the parents. I want to hold all those people up as they're separating these kids at the border. And I'm going, oh, wait a minute. So it's your white child? It's your personal chattel that's valued? But this person's child is expendable? This person's child can be separated? What part of this conversation doesn't make sense here? Not only are you wildly inconsistent, but this isn't about valuing life. This isn't about valuing children. You don't care. All you care is about your kid. And the irony of all this is that when you look at – I say this over and over again. And my Texas audience has heard me say it. I learned so much about Texas, especially about Houston. So Houston has 600,000 undocumented immigrants. That means that they all feel vulnerable as they're watching this administration basically have a war on Hispanics. That's really what this is as much as anything else. Uh-huh. They're not going to be separating Norwegians at the border. All right? They're not going to be separating Canadians at the border. They're only going to be separating people of color if they come from Africa, if they come from Muslim countries, or if they come from Latin America. You are perfectly willing to sort of say, oh, my God, they can be separated. No, you aren't. And as I'm looking at all this, and then I'm realizing that as a result of our low unemployment, we're suddenly realizing that what we need more than anything else is we need a new population influx. We need people to support us if we're to move forward in the economy. What we don't recognize is right now we have 11 million people that are supporting us that we refuse to recognize and value. They're picking our, you know,
right.
our fruit. They're in our meat packing plants. They're cleaning the toilets. They're doing all these things. They're making a life even as they're invisible to us. But not only are they making a life, they're supporting our lives. They're supporting our lives. How do you say that you want them to leave when they're so necessary to who you are and how safe and secure you are? Nobody has ever tied it to that. I even want to say that in West Virginia and Louisiana and Alabama and Mississippi, all these places where they rise the bloody shirt of, you know, immigration policy as if they love Donald Trump for that. They actually hate it, but they don't even quite comprehend how it benefits their lives.
I find it stunning. As you know, we're all immigrants at some point, at some level. We are all immigrants. I believe about three-fourths of all Americans trace their ancestry to after the Civil War.
Yeah.
It leaves me speechless when people don't understand the contributions of these immigrants who come in to put the food on our table because no one else wants to do this back-breaking labor. It leaves me speechless when people don't understand what immigrants do and what they contribute and how hardworking they are, and they become American success stories. We've seen it again and again and again and again. And we often hear this phrase, the goodness of the American people. I am so jaded at this point,
exactly.
Arnie. I'm beginning to think it
exactly.
is a myth.
Yeah.
Americans are no better than anybody else. It's a myth. Because if we were truly a good people, there would be moral outrage at taking children from parents at the border. There would be moral outrage the way we are demonizing people who have a different skin color or a different language. There would be moral outrage. So what is this myth? And that's what it is, the myth of the goodness of the American people.
Well, and I will say something, too. So you mentioned that you wanted to vote for Bill Weld, but that obviously Bill Weld did not qualify. So therefore, you're back to being an undeclared or an independent and that you will support Joe Biden. And I want to also talk about the myth of Joe Biden. And here's my problem. I know Joe not as well as I know Bill and Hillary because I hung out with them in 92 and 96. Not as well as I know a lot of other politicians because John McCain was an old friend, believe it or not. So as I'm looking at Joe Biden, what really scares me is that we are putting all our eggs into a very fragile basket. Joe Biden is no different than the Joe Biden that we saw in the New Hampshire primary, in the Iowa caucuses, in the Nevada caucus. And I don't mean the people that voted or didn't vote for him. I meant the sort of uneven performance, uneven messaging, word salad that comes out of his mouth, sometimes so distracted that you weren't sure he was sort of paying attention. The guy that during debates would say things like, oh, I guess my time is up. It's okay. All right. I can end now. Like, who wants to stop the 1 minute and 30 seconds you have to respond when this answer usually takes 10 minutes? Okay. And I'm watching all that. And the only thing that changed was Jim Clyburn. And sadly, I would rather elect Jim Clyburn than Joe Biden. Because Jim Clyburn shows a level of competence, a level of evenness, an ability to have a conversation, an ability to sort of talk policy that is so much better than Joe Biden. And given you talk about how do we even recognize 2020, looking at all the challenges we face with voter suppression, with Donald Trump, with the Russian bots, with the GOP bots, with everything else that's happening, I am looking at one of the most imperfect, fragile candidates that we are now all being asked to surround and hold up and thinking, how is it possible that this is the choice we have made against Donald Trump? That's the thing that frightens me, is that I think Trump is not only dangerous for us as a nation, I think he is dangerous for the world.
First of all, I agree with your last comment that we cannot survive another 4 years of Donald Trump. Let me make a couple observations about Biden. First and foremost, he will galvanize a type of support that did not come out in the last presidential election. He's proven that in the South already. So that's pretty important. Secondly, I'm a realist. Do I think Biden is a perfect candidate? Hardly. Do I think he's a flawed candidate? Absolutely. However, this is the reality. We're coming down. Unless we have a brokered, the Democrats have a brokered convention, and there's some backroom deal that's going to go on, Biden is the choice. Now is the time to support him. It can't be Bernie Sanders. The dumb things that come out of Bernie's mouth disqualify him to be president. So we're left with Biden. I would also say that, you know, it's now water under the bridge, but part of the ascendancy of Donald Trump is due to Barack Obama. You know, if you go back 13 years.
Wash your mouth out with soap. You're not allowed to say that. Remember, Obama is perfect. He wasn't. He bailed out Wall Street. He didn't bail out Main Street. He basically, he pre-negotiated on the Affordable Care Act, giving the Republicans the Affordable Care Act that they actually drafted, and they still called it a communist plot. So unfortunately, there were some bad political choices that Obama made that actually hurt us in 2016. That was really what led to it.
Let's think about how we got Donald Trump. 13 years, go back 13 years, Edward M. Kennedy, the U.S. Senator from Massachusetts, and his niece, Caroline Kennedy, stood on a stage during the Democratic primary when he was running against Hillary Clinton and said, it's time to pass the torch to a new generation. That's what they said. You had this young, articulate man from Illinois, and they said, you're the future.
Right.
During the 8 years he served in office, and I agree with you, he gave the banks a free pass.
A total free pass. No perp walks. No perp walks. No perp walks. Keep going.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
There are bankers who should be in jail for what they did. We put kids who have pot in jail, but these bankers didn't go to jail. But I digress.
Yes.
So for 8 years, Barack Obama is president. What did he do to bring up new leadership, a new generation? What did he do to mentor young leaders to run for president? What's he do? He stands by, and he passes the torch back to Hillary. Her time had passed. It was over. Why could he not identify young, accomplished, talented woman to run for president?
Absolutely.
He failed to do that.
Yep. No. So I'm going to have to let you go, but let me just say something which is so interesting. I wrote exactly what you just said on my Facebook page, and people talked about his coattails in 2008. And I reminded people that he was president for 8 years and that coattails in 2008 were not coattails in 2009, coattails in 2010, coattails in 2011. That the obligation of a leader is not only to provide a vision and a forward direction, but it's to look back and make sure people are following you and to encourage a bench and to make sure that state legislatures are are changing, to make sure that governors are changing. Your responsibility isn't just to move ahead by yourself. Your responsibility is to scoop up what's happening behind you. And he never did that. There was this idea that he wasn't needed for that, or that that was somebody else's job. No, no, no. It's your job. It's your job. And you were absolutely right. Hillary Clinton, and I've said this over and over again, part of the reason that Joe Biden is a million years better than Hillary Clinton, everybody likes Joe. Hillary Clinton was the most disliked politician on the planet except for Donald Trump in 2016. Can you imagine to have so much negative baggage and then be the anointed of the Democratic Party? I know you want to female as your next president of the United States. I know there was a girl thing going on with Hillary. I'm a girl too. You know, I got breasts too. I want to see someone like that as a president of the United States. But I also know that there are flawed women. And there are certain women that probably are not going to offer us the kind of leadership we need at the time we need it. She was one of them. She had a resume, but there were issues with her resume. She exhausted people. She didn't necessarily enlighten people. And that was part of the problem. It is interesting to be able to talk with you because I feel sort of liberated to be able to sort of say about the weaknesses of Obama, to talk equally about the weaknesses of Joe Biden. But Joe Biden does have an asset. He's much more likable than Hillary Clinton, which is what actually Obama said to Hillary Clinton, you know, you're likable enough, Hillary. Well, actually, she wasn't. And on that note, Paul Peter Jessup, we're having too much fun. You have to do this again. All right.
It's been a pleasure. Always good to be with you, Artie.
Thank you so much. All right, everyone, stick around. We'll be right back. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude. Ciao.
Getting the drift about plastic pollution on this current cast. Almost 22 million pounds of plastic are washed or blown into the Great Lakes each year. Much of that ends up on shorelines far from where it started. Matthew Hoffman of the Rochester Institute of Technology says Chicago's pollution often drifts across the lake to Michigan. Particles from Detroit end up near Buffalo, and debris from Toronto floats across the border toward Rochester. So tackling the problem requires communities across the region to work together.
If you want to reduce pollution on a particular beach, you would not only have to make sure people don't drop things there when they're visiting,
but that people upstream and across the lake are being careful as well. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. So we have a local bookstore in New Hampshire that support your local bookstores anywhere in the country, everyone. I'm just telling you that. And our local bookstore is named Gibson's Bookstore. And on Friday, they have the privilege of the author of a new book showing up. And he's joining me right now on the air. His name is Nolan Higdon. The title of the book is United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. He and Mickey Huff of Project Censored have written this book, and as they describe it, it presents a critique of how corporate-owned media immerses the public in an information system structured to reinforce their social biases and market to their buying preferences. And I want to welcome Nolan to the program. Thank you so much for joining us, Nolan.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So I know you've written this book, but what gives you the expertise to be able to write this book? What has been your experience? What do you do other than book writing in order for my audience to not only want to value what you say, but want to go out and read that book?
Yeah, I'm a university lecturer. I teach in history and media studies. You look at news media and propaganda. I've also served at Project Censored and the Media Freedom Foundation with Mickey Huff. Mickey Huff's the director of Project Censored, the president of the Media Freedom Foundation. He's a professor of social science and history. And we've been writing on these topics and went to graduate school on these topics over the last 20 or 30 years. So we have a lot of experience teaching in this area and researching and publishing in this area as well.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I describe myself as a politician in recovery, and I served in the New Hampshire legislature in the 1980s, and I was the first female to run for governor in 1992 and won the nomination but lost the election, no surprise, in part because I was running both against the Republican Party and to some extent my own party, the Democratic Party. And I've been a Democrat my entire life since I was 15. I've never abandoned the party, although on occasion I think they've abandoned me. But what I find fascinating is I've also been someone who's worked in the media. And I've been lucky enough to work in actually commercial media, not public media. Sometimes public media is a safer place to be, but commercial media is a more interesting place. Sometimes the audiences are more diverse than in public media. And also you're challenged by the corporate ownership of that media. So as I was looking at your book, I couldn't help but smile. And I've told this story to my radio audience before, but I'll share it with you, Nolan. I did commercial media for about 20 years. And at one point, I replaced Rush Limbaugh, believe it or not, on five stations in New Hampshire because the guy that had Rush Limbaugh's contract had lost his contract to one of the larger outfits that had bought out his contract. And then I ended up working for another commercial station. And it's a Tuesday morning, and I get fired by that commercial station Tuesday morning. Tuesday afternoon, my husband begs me to go to the New Hampshire Association of Broadcasters award dinner that night. And I said, I'm not going. I just got fired. Why the H would I go? And he begged me and begged me. So I ended up dragging my knuckles and showing up. Why did he want me to go? Because I won Broadcaster of the Year that night. And the reason and I've actually won a variation on that theme three times. I think I may be the only person to win it for both TV and for radio. So why did I get fired? And this goes directly, I think, to what you write about. I got fired not because of radio audience, not because of audience share. I got fired because of the corporate advertisers. And the corporate advertisers were offended because when your advertising is the pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry, the car industry, and you are talking truth to power, you're actually not only valuing, you know, the drug that they may have come up with, but you also have to remind people the price that you pay. You may value the fact that you have four wheels and you can get yourself to work, but you may look at the SUV they're selling you and realizing that the SUV is getting, you know, 14 miles to the gallon at a time when the price of oil has gone through the roof and, frankly, it's an environmental danger, and you refer to SUVs on occasion as FUVs. Because if you need one, buy one, but if you don't need one, maybe you shouldn't buy one. And I would go to the mat if you needed one, you know? But what you needed was, you know, a vehicle and a reliable vehicle, not something that would actually harm the environment and be impossible to park. So that was what was so interesting. So I see why I am now on a community radio station. We're on the Pacifica Network, so we're all heard all over the country as a result of the fact that we give it away. But I have now been giving away my voice for 7 years. Most people need to monetize their voice in order to survive. And yet the reason why I can't monetize it can't be supported by the commercial corporate media because they won't do it. And frankly, to some extent, I'm a little too liberal even for public radio because they need to be safe. There are certain people they can't offend. So as we look at this, maybe this is part of the reason why you wrote this book, is that it's really hard now to actually understand whether you're hearing what is accurate information or whether you're being manipulated, because we are living, I think, in the United States of distraction.
Yeah, there's a lot of, your story speaks to this too. There's a lot of good people in media who do want to be journalists, who do want to cover controversial topics, but they go in there and working in these corporate outlets, they soon figure out, and we hear this firsthand, this isn't speculating, we hear this firsthand, that once they go into these corporate outlets, they quickly learn what you can and can't say. And so, you know, sometimes when we criticize corporate media, some folks will shoot back at us in the industry and say, well, it's not that we're not censored. We can talk about whatever we want. It's like, theoretically, you're not told you can't talk about something, but you learn what you can and can't talk about. And so you start to structure your messages, your topics, to what works at the company. Dan Rather talked about this. He said, they don't tell me what you can and can't say, but they say, like, here's what gets good ratings, here's what doesn't, here's what we cover at this station, here's what draws in viewers. And so you start to learn and get manipulated. That's why you have people who don't really do much journalism anymore in corporate networks. Instead, they play the part of, you know, somewhere between reporters and talking heads. They don't actually go out and investigate and find out reasons why. They give you a timeline of events and then give you their opinion on it. So we've lost a lot of that journalism, because to do journalism is to be controversial. You're going to find things that people don't want known, and generally those are people in power. And we have a weird situation in this country where six corporations control 90% of our news media. So if you're speaking truth to power, you're probably criticizing those people, and they don't have any economic interest in keeping you on the air.
As I'm looking at your book, it says the role of news media in a free society is to investigate, inform, and provide a crucial check on political power. But does it? Well, that's exactly your point. They don't want to be investigated. They don't want you to inform, and they absolutely don't want you to provide a check on political power, because it's political power that they really sort of they desire. I mean, you see it whether it's a Republican administration or a Democratic administration. You know, it's called, you know, the thousands and thousands of lobbyists they hire. It's about looking at where the money flows into chairman of committees. It's about looking at the revolving door where they go from, you know, representing, you know, the federal government, supposedly doing a check on the SEC and then going to work for a corporation literally hours after they leave the SEC. So it is frustrating, but has it ever been really different? I guess I'm going to ask you, because you wrote this book and it's a critique of where we are now. But I guess I'm trying to figure out, where have we been?
Yeah, so we were, we were at a conference in Washington D.C. and we were approached by our publisher, City Lights, and this was when everyone was sort of panicking about the election of Trump. And by this point, we had sort of developed a reputation where we had said, you know, we're going down this bad path in our media and our political system. And so City Lights said, "Well, would you write a book about Trump?" And we kind of went, "Eh." There's so many books about Trump. We don't think Trump should be the focal point. We think Trump is more of the symptom of this long process. We'd happily write a book about the process that got us here and what we can do about it. And so in the book, we talk about how things sort of changed and developed over time to allow the election of Trump and the current state of our politics and media. And we really focus back on the 1970s as kind of a pivotal transformational decade. Okay. In that journalism was kind of at an all-time popular high, in the sense that the Watergate scandal had emerged, new journalistic institutions like Project Censored hit the scene, you had the revelations about the Vietnam War, you had revelations about the Church Committee, and there was this big sort of push for journalism, but those in power didn't really like what journalists were doing. Similarly, a lot of those revelations actually hurt the Democratic Party, which at the time was the party that said government works.
Right.
So even though
Good
Democrats
point.
Were using government, by using government, they were revealing these atrocities by government, which actually undermined people's faith in government. And so coming in the 1980s, we saw the sort of Reagan Revolution, and it was this message of government is bad, and they started lowering taxes, deregulating. One of the things they deregulated was the media industry. So in the 80s, we used to have a fairness doctrine. You talked about
right.
Rush Limbaugh. Well, in 87, we stopped using the fairness doctrine, which had been around since the 40s. And the fairness doctrine said if you attack a certain position or critique a certain position, you have to allow equal time for someone advocating for that position to be on your program or in your newspaper. By 87, we got rid of all of that. That's the same year Rush Limbaugh launched.
Wow.
In 90, 1996.
Is that true? That's the same year. That's amazing. Just to know that little sort of factoid is kind of remarkable. We get rid of fairness and up comes Rush. All right, keep going.
Right.
It's kind of remarkable.
Yeah. In 1934, we had a rule in the book that you were limited on how many media outlets you could own in a particular market. In 1996, the Republicans in Congress with Bill Clinton signed the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and they got rid of that. So now you could own as many media markets as you wanted. This is the same year Fox and MSNBC are coming out, and they consolidate the market. We go from 50 corporations controlling news media down to 6.
Wow.
And then shortly before Clinton leaves office, he works with the Republicans in Congress to pass the Communications Decency Act, which has Section 230, mm-hmm. which says that anything that's published on a social media platform, you cannot hold the company accountable. This allows the development of social media because social media companies are not responsible for anything you publish on there. If it's a lie, if it's a threat, if it's dangerous,
wow,
you can't hold Facebook accountable. So really, the lack of legislation, if you will, or lack of government regulation ended up shaping our media market. It empowered a few corporations to control the flow of information. And the political parties were not ignorant of this. The Republican Party really galvanized the message of around like Fox News and these other outlets, eventually online with Breitbart and Alex Jones. The Democrats were a little late to the game, but they would get MSNBC and then eventually Huffington Post. And both sides were not necessarily concerned with fact. They were focused on winning. And it became a battle of winning, not necessarily telling the truth or passing the best policy. And now we're in this sort of critical state in American politics. We talk about these vulnerabilities in the book. The first vulnerability we talk about is we have this sort of hyper-sensationalized media. So they replaced actual news with entertainment. And this was perfect for Donald Trump, right? Donald Trump had been on The Apprentice and this reality television show and The Sensationalistic Candidate. So it really paved the way for him. Similarly, another vulnerability we talk about is hyper-partisanship. There's no longer a fact, and we disagree on what the facts mean. There's one set of facts on the right, and there's one set of facts on the left. And we're in kind of our own bubble. And this partisanship has gotten, you know, to quite a scary degree. Polls are showing that for the first time in American history, parents actually disapprove of their children marrying or dating someone from the opposite political party. It's never been polled in history.
Oh, God. I want to go back to something you said because it's gnawing at me. Go back to Bill Clinton. What did he do just before he left office? What kind of immunity did he provide for the media companies? Explain that to me again. Just refresh my recollection because I'm going to tell you why I'm focusing like a laser on that because it goes to something that's actually happening right now and I want to connect the two. So can you just tell me again what it was? What was the law that he passed?
Yeah, for sure. Clinton is often misremembered as a liberal. I mean, he was more Reagan than Ronald Reagan. But he worked with the Republicans to pass a series of legislation deregulating a bunch of industries, including Wall Street at the end of his administration.
Oh, no, trust me. We know that.
What I was talking about was the Communication Decency Act. And Section 230 of that act absolved tech companies from anything that's published on their platform. So you can't sue them for libel or lies or things like that, which you could do for a newspaper.
Wow.
So all it took was Mark Zuckerberg and MySpace and the other social media companies to realize, oh, we can create a platform where anybody can say anything, we can collect their data, and we can't get sued. Like, it's a moneymaker.
So the reason why this is just like banging in my head is one of the big things that we hear about Bernie Sanders is that he voted to give the gun industry immunity, okay, legal protection for, you know, whatever happens in a wide range of things that happen with a gun manufacturer. And people just are so angry at him for having done that. What I think is so interesting is that we should be equally angry, if maybe as much, if not more angry, at Bill Clinton for providing immunity to these huge media operations that are not responsible for what's on their platforms. It's exactly the same thing. And to an even interesting extent, it might even be more insidious. But nobody ever sort of says, all right, you know, and Bernie admits that was a mistake. Do we admit today, do the Clintons, do the Bidens, do the Obamas, do the Democrats admit that decision by Bill Clinton to do this was a mistake? a huge mistake because, as you point out, you know, how distracted we are. Well, that's because so much information is misinformation, it's lies, it's distortion, and yet nobody is responsible for that content. And I just think that in an interesting way, when you mention that, I'm like, oh, my God, everybody knows about Bernie Sanders and the gun immunity. Nobody talks about this. And yet if there's a time to talk about it, it is right now.
Yeah, we were in – I mean, again, you know, it's such a hyper-partisan climate that now if you criticize
I know.
The Clinton era, you're automatically accused of being like a Republican or a Trump supporter and vice versa. But – I mean, the facts are what they are. You know, Clinton deregulated Wall Street. Yeah. He got rid of bankruptcy protections. He deregulated the media. A lot of contemporary society is due to the moves he made at his presidency. And that's not to mention things like NAFTA or the homophobic DOMA and Don't Ask, Don't Tell and things like that. I mean, there's a pretty ugly history there from the 90s. And you brought up Joe Biden's name. I mean, he's right there in that camp supporting these and the crime bill and other things in the 90s as well. But they come down to one thing Bernie Sanders voted on and has apologized for, yet this litany of horrible and atrocious legislation that Biden took part in with the Clintons and others just sort of goes under the radar, not even mentioned or discussed.
Well, so what I'm fascinated by is, okay, I understand where we are today. I understand it way too well, and it terrifies me. So I'm going to ask you to do something for me, Nolan. Give me 5 points, 5 things that we can do that can begin to rehabilitate the situation that we are in. It's hard to change people's heads. It's hard to change their souls. It's hard to change, you know, what they assume. But sometimes, what do they say in architecture? Function follows form. And I want to know what kind of form that we could change that will eventually allow people to begin to get the kind of information they need, process that information that they need, and make sure that these companies are accountable. So I'm going to make you sort of the master of the universe for the next 5 minutes and say to my audience, okay, these are the prescriptions for us to look at. And then when we have candidates in front of us, when we have governors, members of Congress, maybe even presidential candidates, we can ask them what it is they would do and would they embrace this?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll go over some of them. I'll say that the book is very focused on solutions. It's not just a paragraph at the end. We have a chapter that goes through these different solutions, but I'll go through some of them here. One of the main ones I'm a huge advocate for and worked with a lot of people across the country on this, like the Action Coalition for Media Education and Project Censor, is we want to get what we call a critical media literacy education in our classrooms. About 40 or so years ago, most countries in Europe, Asia, parts of Northern Africa, they instituted media literacy. We did not. So we dropped a media bomb upon a generation with no way to kind of sift through it and determine fact from fiction. So I would advocate, you know, as if I was dictator for a day, I would put it in our schools.
Yeah.
But at the very least, I encourage, you know, parents and community members and children and students to get access to a media literacy education. But I strongly emphasize the critical. Some of the media literacy that is out there is made by corporations like Nickelodeon or Facebook or Google or Sony, and they have, you know, the slick content that they want to put in classrooms, and a lot of teachers and parents fall for it. But really what they're trying to do is get their tools in the classroom, collect mm-hmm. your students' data, and get your students dependent upon their tools. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a media literacy where we look at, like, the power dynamics behind it, who funds it, how the funding affects it.
And to ask those questions.
What stories they privilege, et cetera.
Right. I go to theconversation.com all the time, and I don't know if you've ever seen that site. But one of the reasons why I value it is not only is it brilliant sort of PhDs and professors from around the world. I think it's in about maybe 20 countries now. But one of the things they do is, so you have someone who's writing about a topic, right? And there's the name of the professor or professors that are writing about the topic. And then it talks about their financial connections, who they've worked for in the past, in order to make sure that there's full disclosure about what you are reading, so you either may put it through a lens depending on their connections, or if you know that there's a level of independence that maybe you value that word more than something else. And I think that that's something that I'm so glad they provide, but now it needs to be taught that we should demand it all the time, because unless you know who's paying for this, you may not realize that what you are getting is what you used to get from the tobacco industry, that, you know, cigarettes don't cause cancer. Well, they had a financial interest in saying that. They also found scientists to support it. Guess what? Lie, 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 and lie. And that would be important for students to realize that sometimes because it comes out of an industry or a scientist, it might not necessarily be, you know, independent information.
I completely agree. And, you know, I'm sad to report that, you know, some of my colleagues, other professors like myself, people in academia, they do take money from these companies.
Of course,
so some of the media literacy people you need to be careful of.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one thing I would say is add media literacy to the classroom, and also for the reasons you pointed out. Second, I would encourage people to avoid news inflation. More is not better. You know, it's a lot better to read less articles more thoroughly and fact check them.
Very good point.
Than it is to read as many headlines as possible.
Right.
Yeah, closely related. I would kind of cut down on your corporate media diet. I would go for independently funded media. You can do things on the, you know, sort of left, like Common Dreams, for example, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of media outlets aren't bad. They give you a certain story on the right. You know, you've got like the Federalist or something like that. And you
right.
can compare right versus left without
right.
that corporate funding and see what they're kind of focused on, see what their message is.
But who do you recommend for investigative reporting? I go to ProPublica a lot. I use them. I think they've been very, very, very helpful when it comes to looking for information. And so I'm just, you know, when it comes to looking at issues on the left, I go to the American Prospect. I think David Dayan, who's their new editor, is just fabulous. So, I mean, I there are certain places that I go to on a fairly regular basis. But I will tell you, Sinclair News is going to sound awful. Sinclair News as a TV outlet is pathetic. But what's so fascinating for me is read their news content. Read the pieces that they put that support what apparently is what you're seeing on TV. Too often people just watch the television set. So I look at Channel 9, my local station, WMUR. I don't necessarily care for what I see on the TV, but then I begin to look deeper and I find out that some of their news guys that are actually doing some of the print stuff to support it are actually giving me the content that I'm not seeing on the TV. So a lot of ways it's also forcing us to be more critical and also to look deeper, as you point out.
Yeah, and that was a – I want to go back to one of these. That's like a third thing I was going to say, which is pay attention to local news. You have more power
Absolutely.
Over the local in your community than you do nationally. So don't get into the horse race politics of national elections and things. There's a lot more important things going on at the local. But if I go back to something you said, I think one of the mistakes we've made in recent history is we've played the outlet game, like you're either a New York Times person or a Fox News person or MSNBC versus
right.
CNN.
Right.
I encourage you to get below that. Instead of following the outlet, follow the journalists, because a lot of outlets have bad journalists, but
Thank
they also
you.
Have really good journalists.
Thank you.
That because they're tied to an outlet, they don't get paid attention to. So, you know, I mean, there's some people doing like incredible critical work right now of investigative journalism. I think of like Glenn Greenwald, Manar Mahawish at Min Press News, Abby Martin, her work, Aaron Mate has done some incredible stuff. And so those kind of investigative journalists, I think, are doing some great work that often, you know, go against some of their ideological adherence, but they let the information kind of take them where it may.
Well, and so The Intercept does that on a lot of occasions. And what I end up doing, though, is what I love about The Intercept is that it makes me think about something in a different way. And then when I see this sort of more mainstream New York Times, Washington Post journalists, I then query them. And I'm like, well, what about this? Did you explore this? And I used to teach mass communication, Nolan. And one of the things I remind my students over and over again, and this is part of, I think, the media education you were talking about, and I would describe it this way. I said, you have a lens in your hand, okay? And you look down at the table, and what do you see? You may see grains of wood. Now I want you to expand the size of your lens, and what do you see? Oh, you see a table. Now I want to expand the lens, and what do you see? You see the table is in your classroom. Okay, now I want to expand the lens. What do you see? You see your classrooms in a school. And I said, here's part of the problem. It's not that people aren't being accurate with the information. They're just giving you this tiny little lens. Part of your job is to sort of start demanding that the lens is bigger and bigger so you begin to understand the context, where it is, what aren't they telling you, and the things that they're not telling you might actually undermine what their agenda is. And that is a media literacy that we have forgotten to teach people. I'm not sure they were ever taught this, but now more than ever, I think they need to be.
Yeah, one of the, you know, in addition to our book, United States of Distraction, we publish kind of monthly blogs at projectcensored.org. And recently I came back from the Nevada primary, and I went there to basically watch the press in the press tent.
Yeah.
And I do this every couple of years.
Yep, yep.
And I'm always amazed at sort of how they're like flies on manure for the powerful. They're like following around Tom Steyer and Tom Perez with cameras. Meanwhile, there's all these like working class women of color coming in to vote, and they're out there sharing their feelings, and there's like no press cameras around them.
Right.
So we wrote about this at projectcensored.org, but I think it speaks to something else I was going to say as well, which is we also need to remember to teach all of us, older people, younger people, everyone, need to remember to be taught journalism. We ask young people to read the news and to give their opinions on it, but we don't actually teach them what journalists do. It's not a mandatory class.
Thank you.
And the examples of journalism they've seen in their lives have been terrible. It's been Chris Matthews and Bill O'Reilly and these, and those aren't journalists.
Right.
So I think taking a step back and sort of reminding folks what journalists do, and even in Nevada, I wanted to take so many opportunities to reach out to journalists to remind them what they're supposed to do.
And on that note, I need to say goodbye to you. Nolan Higdon and Mickey Huff of Project Censored wrote United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation, and Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. They're coming probably to a local bookstore near you. They're coming to one in Concord, New Hampshire this Friday. So thank you so much for joining us. And again, I think media education is important, but guess what? Just calling it media education, it may not be. So that's part of the question. Is this the kind of education our kids need to have in order to be informed citizens? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is the Friday edition of The Attitude. We will talk to you next week. Ciao.